Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on the web, 989fm.com.au, or on the podcast a little bit later, welcome to you as well. It's good to have your company this morning. Now, in late March, an important report was handed down, the Royal Commission into Family Violence down in Victoria, which probed the horrifying statistics affecting that state, but also had obvious repercussions around the nation. And it was very much welcomed by women's groups, legal groups, human rights organisations, because something was actually happening. Now, that Royal Commission also heard quite a lot from Aboriginal community-controlled organisations, and there was a whole suite of recommendations specifically looking at the situation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women and children. Now, we know that when we look at our communities, the situation around family violence is completely different. It often comes from a completely different place. So today, perhaps a little bit belatedly, we'll be looking a bit at those differences and what could potentially come from the Royal Commission in Victoria, but how this could maybe affect our circumstances across the country. So joining me on the program today is a University of New South Wales law expert, Kylie Cripps, who's a Palawa woman from Tasmania. She has had a long history in researching Aboriginal violence and sexual assault in Aboriginal communities, but obviously from an Aboriginal women's perspective, which is something that we don't hear a lot, but which a lot of Aboriginal women have been working in this field for a very long time. So she knows her stuff. And later in the program, we'll also hear from the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples, Jackie Huggins, who's obviously a Murray woman from up here and also has a long history in trying to make these issues affecting women and children, Aboriginal women and children specifically, known from an Aboriginal woman's viewpoint. And she's had decades of experience doing that. But we'll start with Kylie Cripps this morning. I spoke to her last week about the ramifications of the Royal Commission, but specifically about some of the more concerning recommendations and how they might not actually work in the favour of Aboriginal women and children. Here's Kylie Cripp. From your perspective, Aboriginal family violence is always recognised now. I guess the statistics are really too high for anyone to ignore. But I guess how do the causes of Aboriginal family violence differ from family violence in a mainstream context?
I think the differentiation between Indigenous and non-Indigenous is that we've got quite a significant history of dispossession. Yeah. We've got a history of negative engagement with government services, which means that we are less reluctant or more nervous, I suppose, in terms of engaging with police, engaging with hospitals, engaging with other services that might be of assistance to us in these difficult circumstances. Yeah. And we've also got quite a history of our children being stolen.
Yeah.
And so when you look at that history, and particularly when we look at children in care presently, the Royal Commission last week found that 80% of Indigenous children in out-of-home care in Victoria were related to family violence.
Yep.
Right, so there's those issues. And I think the other point to make is when you're sitting around a table doing a case presentation around child protection, those histories become very important.
Mm.
It's not unusual to be sitting at a table and there's three generations of family members that have been removed from their family, and a fourth is sitting in front of you, potentially about to be removed or already in the care system. So when we're looking at how do we respond, it's recognising that there's this history that other Australians don't necessarily have.
Yeah.
And it's also recognising that history comes with a trauma that we don't necessarily have, we haven't necessarily had the resources to respond to. So, if you're a child that was removed in the 60s as part of the Stolen Generation movement and you haven't had access to counselling,
yeah,
if all you knew was growing up in an institution, How does that affect your parenting skills today? How does that affect how you manage particular situations today? And what access have you had in terms of support services to help you understand your circumstances to be able to move forward in a positive and caring and loving relationships with your family members? It's that kind of history that really impacts on how we understand and how we respond to family violence today.
And that's actually something you've done quite a lot in your research, haven't you? You talk about group one and group two factors. And when I was reading this, you know, this thing about the factors, I mean, it seems the victim and the perpetrator are both victims of it, isn't it? It's a very complex relationship between the two.
Yeah, absolutely. So when it comes to responding then, it's, you know, when we look at services as they're currently set up, you have your separate services for drug and alcohol problems, you have your separate services for family violence, you have separate services for child protection.
Yeah.
And when you're looking at those factors that contribute to violence, you know, it's not unusual for an Indigenous client to be able to tick all those boxes.
Mm.
And so sending them off to a drug and alcohol service to deal with that issue and then sending them off to another service to deal with this issue, it is actually, it's not dealing with the person as a whole, and it's not dealing with how all of those issues intersect to make the person they are today. And so we actually need services that, to, you know, if a person presents and they want help today, then you're the person that organises that help. And, you know, people get quite practiced in telling this story to a whole range of audiences.
Yeah, right. Which can add to the trauma, I guess.
Absolutely. Absolutely it does. And so my approach, and certainly, you know, since 2003 with the Gordon Inquiry, there's been recommendations for a one-stop shop where you have a service that has all of the services that a person could possibly need in responding to family violence, and they're all housed in the one place. They all have access to the one file.
Yeah.
And so there's that need to have to continually repeat your story.
Yeah.
Is diminished. And I think that that's an important thing. And, you know, when we separate issues like drug and alcohol use, for example, if we think about the trauma that people have experienced, and we think about how does a normal person cope with those kind of circumstances? In, you know, do they increase their smoking? Do they turn inside themselves? Do they become, you know, do they turn to drug and alcohol use to numb the pain? You know, I think you can't isolate those individual factors out of who the person is that's in front of you and what their experiences as a whole are. And our system, our service system, hasn't been great in responding in that way and in dealing with the person as a whole person.
Do you think the Royal Commission has been able to grapple with the complexity of that? Because I think the reason your piece was so important is that you actually look critically at some of their recommendations.
Yeah, I think, I suppose the Commission has, you know, there's a lot of complexities around family violence, and I think that they've tackled many of those complexities. And I think in some respects, what will be the response back? I mean, the recommendations are useful and appropriate to the circumstances and the evidence that they heard. But I suppose what we consistently see in terms of responses to Royal Commissions and responses to inquiries is that, you know, we have a wealth of recommendations, but 2 years later, 5 years later, 10 years later, how many of them have actually produced change in the way that we respond to these problems? And, you know, I think recommendations are easy. I think the implementation is the difficult one. And I think with our, you know, government's change power, they have different priorities. And the work of responding to family violence is difficult. I don't think we can escape that. And I mean, you only have to look at Little Children Are Sacred, for example.
Mm.
You know, we had all these services flying into the Northern Territory, but are those services there 18 months later, 2 years later, 7 years later? That's what we need. I mean, if we treated family violence in the same way that we treat cancer, where we have prevention services, where we have early detection services, where we have ongoing treatment services, we have counselling, we have the clinical treatment, if we treated family violence in the same way we treated cancer, we might be further down the road than we are today.
I guess we always focus, and it's something that you've brought up in your research, the criminalisation of family violence. I was really interested in what you're saying about the problems around expanding the Koori Court's jurisdiction in Victoria. I thought that was really important. Why are there problems around that?
I think when we think about the Koori Court and the purpose of the Koori Court, originally the intent of the Koori Court was to respond to juvenile justice issues, right? It was to capture those young people early in these kind of behaviours and to respond to them and say, hey, the community is watching you, the community understands that you've got issues and we're here to support you, to catch you and to support you in moving forward with your life, right? When we get to, and I think that for juveniles this is an appropriate avenue, the Koori Court. But when we look at family violence, often when we, when it becomes to the attention of police, this won't be the first instance. Mm. This won't be the second instance. This particular family may have experienced family violence for several years before the police get involved. And so the dynamics that you have sitting around that table is you're responding to, in the Koori Court is specifically for offenders.
Yeah.
So if you don't enable a victim to be part of that process, to be able to tell their story of years of abuse, you're not necessarily getting a full understanding of what that offender has been up to. And I don't necessarily believe that you're being able to respond in a way that is sensitive to that power and control dynamic that they've had in their family.
Do you find... keep going.
I think that it is really difficult to think about how do you produce a Koori Court environment that recognises the victim's experiences?
That's what I was just going to say, because obviously the offender, even now, I guess, even when you look at the mainstream debate, and I guess it would be the same historically, has the sort of focus always been on the offender at the expense of the victim, would you say?
Yeah, for Koori Court processes, the focus has been on the offender, and largely it's been an initiative that's come out of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. It's a recognition that we have considerably highly disproportionate numbers of Indigenous men in prison, and a lot of them are in prison for violence-related matters. Right? So I think that, if we're wanting to reduce the disproportionate numbers of Indigenous men in prison, and we need to think about this more holistically. We can't just say Koori Court is the answer. We're going to get the community to tell this fella that he's being watched and his conduct's inappropriate, mm-hmm. and we're going to tell him he needs to do a bit of counselling and some behaviour change programs. But what kind of message are you sending back to the victim?
Yeah.
Right? And what kind of supports are you wrapping around her? And what kind of supports are you wrapping around the family unit? Because if it is that he gets sent to jail, and if he's not got any interventions wrapped around him in prison, he comes out more angry and she cops it again.
Yeah.
So unless we respond to this in a way that responds to both parties, both the victim and the offender, and also their kids, then we're at risk of this cycle continuing.
And we're in a really sad situation now where women are being jailed for family violence, aren't we?
So absolutely.
The victims are becoming the perpetrators who are then being victimised again.
Yeah, and unfortunately that's, when people turn, the poster in the conversation article about the barriers to reporting, police turn up and they're going to see, in particularly violent situations, they may see that the guy's got a bloody nose and the woman's got a bloody lip, and they're going to ask the guy, so what happened? And he's going to say, well, she hit me. And then she's going to say, he hit her. And the police are in a no-win situation. Both parties have been assaulted and they're going to charge both. And again, you can't tell a woman not to fight back.
No.
In the sense that, know, these are really precarious situations, and how does one defend oneself? How does one, you know, if the person hasn't had access to services to think about practically safety planning around what do I do if my partner comes home and he's angry? You know, if I know that I haven't got dinner on the table and that's going to make him even angrier, what can I do to get out of the situation? Right? If nobody's done that work with her, then I think, you know, when push comes to shove, and that's probably a bad choice of words, but when it does come push to shove, you know, she will want to defend herself. Yeah. Any person in that situation would want to defend themselves.
Yeah, definitely.
And I suppose it comes to that point of how does our criminal justice system, which is rather a blunt instrument, respond to family violence, because they don't necessarily see the full context of what's happened.
You've talked a little bit about in your research around the underreporting of violence, and that was something that was obviously brought up in the Royal Commission, that Aboriginal women are highly more likely to underreport. I mean, what are the main reasons for that, would you say?
I think in terms of the underreporting, I think it comes back to, you know, women aren't naive. They appreciate that if I'm going to report, it's going to have a whole range of consequences. And it's about navigating those consequences. It's thinking about, right, if I report to the police, what consequences is that going to have for me? Mm. What consequences is that going to have for my partner? What consequences is it going to have for both our families and our children? And what is it all going to mean ultimately in terms of getting the violence to stop? Right? Yeah. So when you're thinking about the harsh realities of what we see in the news and on the TV about deaths in custody, when we see about that the witnessing of family violence by children is seen as abuse, and the child protection will remove children on that basis. Women are incredibly reluctant to report in those circumstances, to even go to a shelter these days. You know, women also think about, well, I've got a 12-year-old son, and the refuge won't take kids over the age.
Where does the son go?
Where does the son go? I can't leave him with my partner because what's that going to teach him?
Yeah.
Right? So they're navigating all of these situations. They're navigating the risks involved in reporting. And, you know, it's a difficult place for them to be. It is a really difficult place for them to be. And even if there are people in the community that are supportive of their position and are trying to get them out of violence, they're also conscious of there are a lot of people that they're trying to please, and it won't necessarily please them in the end.
Is that a big part of it, this fear of the community backlash, do you think?
I think so. I certainly think so. There are a number of case study examples that I could give in the context of, you know, someone reporting and reporting sexual assault, for example, and that's probably the most underreported. Reporting sexual assault and the offender's family, you know, the lateral violence that victim will cop from potentially the offender's family, or even more broadly, the community in general, in terms of what services or surveillance might come into play after that report. Mm. And, you know, that's a really difficult place to be for those victims, to be thinking about, you know, the community, I think, in some respects, expects that if we tell her to drop the charges, that she has that power. And the reality is that they don't. Yeah. Once that you report something having happened to you to the police, you become a witness in a case of the state against the offender.
And it's taken out of your hands completely.
It's completely taken out of your hands. You are subpoenaed to participate in court. You can choose not to, and there may be a penalty for that. But you ultimately don't have a choice in whether that case proceeds or not. That is entirely up to the legal system. So I think, you know, in terms of the lateral violence and the pressure that occurs in our communities to get those charges dropped, I think it's incredibly misguided. I think people need some education around what powers or not a person has in those circumstances.
You've talked a bit about in your research how victims usually report, and it's always about going to maybe a community member, maybe an elder, maybe a close friend first, isn't it? That is that sort of unique to Aboriginal women? They're more likely to do that?
I don't think it's necessarily unique in the sense that I think most victims, whether you're Indigenous or non-Indigenous, will go to a trusted person first, right? And depending on the reception that they receive from that trusted person, it'll be about from that situation as to whether it progresses to a report to the police or a report to health services. Typically, I think the first point of call will be the our elders or our aunties, our mums will be saying, "Let's get your injuries attended to. Let's make sure that you're okay."
Yeah.
Before they go to the next step and say, okay, we need to secure your safety. These are the options that are available to do that.
So it's about building that capacity for, I guess, people within communities to be able to sort of help victims who may be close to them. Is there enough mechanisms to support that?
I think in some areas, absolutely. I think in Victoria, for example, they have Indigenous Family Violence Regional Action Groups. So people that are genuinely interested in the area of family violence, Indigenous community members, to get together and talk about and run activities in the community to raise awareness about family violence. And those people become known in the community as the go-to person.
Yeah.
If I haven't got someone that I trust in my inner circle, then perhaps that's a person that I can go to that might be able to help me. And that's an incredible resource to have in those communities that have them. But I equally think that the resources that we have in all of us live in communities where we know, you know, there's a trusted elder or a trusted auntie that, you know, we go around and we have a cup of tea to, or who will offer us a bed for the night, that kind of thing. And I think we actually have to acknowledge what they do in those circumstances, and they don't necessarily get the recognition that they deserve.
And there's a lot of pressure. They are, I was going to say, there's a lot of pressure on them as well, you know, and a lot of trauma that they actually take on from hearing all these stories continually.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when we talk about lateral violence, it's not just the victim that's going to cop it, it's also going to be potentially their supporters.
Yeah.
And so it's about how do we break that down? How do we break that down to ensure that what we offer up in response to family violence is a supportive environment and not a judgmental one?
And I guess
or a more dangerous circumstance.
Definitely. And I guess that brings us back to one of the other criticism, or not really a criticism, but one of the recommendations of the Royal Commission was about culturally appropriate services, more, you know, funding for Aboriginal community control organisations. But you also said there's a need to sort of skill up mainstream organisations culturally, because there are problems with victims being able to access Aboriginal organisations.
Absolutely. And I think in that context, it's wonderful to have a community control sector that can engage with these issues.
Yeah.
I think it's fabulous. But what we can't deny is that when, you know, we'll have a range of community people involved in those services, and, you know, the community isn't necessarily aware of what happens in one particular family at a particular time. So say they've got a worker or their auntie or their uncle works in a particular organisation, and someone reports an instance of violence. I think it's about thinking, is that organisation a safe place for a victim to go to if the offender's family work there?
Yeah.
Right? We're small communities, and information gets shared quite easily and freely. And sometimes in these family violence situations, people are really shamed up by it. And they want to keep their information as confidential as possible. They don't want, and until they work it out on their terms, they don't want every person knowing their business and what's going on.
Yeah.
So to have a mainstream service that is culturally attuned, that is culturally safe and responsive to Indigenous women and children is absolutely essential. It has to be there as the backup in the instance that an Aboriginal woman or her child decides that they need to seek support elsewhere. And to not have that service is actually to take away the self-determination of those women and children to choose a service on their terms. And that's not appropriate either. We actually need to enable and support women in their choice-making around service delivery.
You've also written a bit about language, which I think is very interesting, about how we may not be able to understand the true, I guess, reality of the problem in the way that, you know, defining family violence in a lot of Aboriginal communities. I guess, what are the sort of ways we sort of talk around family violence specific to like an Aboriginal context? Like, we might not say it's family violence, we might say it's something else.
Yeah. And I think that's an important one in terms of, you know, it might take 6 counselling sessions before someone finds out that the client that's sitting in front of them was raped.
Yeah.
That is because people use a different language that they in trying to describe their issues. And it's because they don't share information until they've developed a trust or a rapport with someone. And it's also about, you know, to actually come out and say, I was raped, is a big deal.
Mm.
It comes with consequences.
Yeah.
And so people tend to minimise what it is that they're experiencing until they come to a level of knowledge and awareness around what it is that they've experienced and are feeling safe enough to talk about it on their terms, in their language. And so I think we have to respect that. I think that services need to have their, you know, they need to be aware of the choices that people make in terms of that language, in terms of, you know, I might just say, oh, we had a little fight.
Yeah.
And it's up to a service provider to say, so a little fight, what did that look like? You know, were you just arguing?
Yeah, right.
Did that arguing escalate into a shove? Did that argument escalate into someone getting hit? What happened after the argument?
Yeah, right.
So, all right. So teasing out that language to understand the situation more fully.
It's interesting because I can see, because I know just looking at who, you know, you sort of got a progression, a timeline of what usually happens when a victim goes to a close friend or a relative, mm. then they go to a health professional. I can see how the process towards reporting can get stuck on so many different levels before it goes to the police because of all these issues, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And as I said previously, you know, the big issue here is the person that you choose to share your story with for the first time, if their response is negative, then your reporting will go no further.
Right.
Right? So, because the trust that you invested in them to hear your story and to help you understand and to help you create a safety in your life is, you know, if they don't provide that, if they don't, you know, if they turn to you and say, you weren't raped.
Mm.
You must have, you know, when he slapped you on, you must have deserved it. What'd you do?
Yeah.
If that's the response, then you've completely closed down the victim.
Right.
The victim is not going to share their story with someone else. You've blown their trust.
Yeah.
And so it's about how do you create people's awareness and response oh, I'm so sorry that happened to you. What do you need? What can I do?
Yeah, right.
You know, if the response is a supportive one, then the circumstances can be incredibly different.
Is there ever a case where, I guess, people maybe in that position looking out for signs of family violence, how do they approach maybe a victim? Is that something that's also a problem with reporting if you are concerned about the
I think Yeah, I think, you know, people are always nervous and worried about, well, what's the response going to be if I confront someone about it? And I think, you know, if you take someone out for a coffee or a cup of tea or and you say, hey, I'm really worried about you. Mm. You know, you haven't been yourself lately. Is there something going on? Is there something I can help you with? You know, are you overwhelmed with the stuff with the kids or, you know, what's going on? Is there something that I can help you with? You create an opportunity for them to share on their terms. And they mightn't share with you the first time. But if you keep on checking in with them and if you start to see bruising and the like, and you take the courage within you to actually ask, how did you get that bruise on your eye? Now, I'm really worried for you.
Yeah.
You know, have you seen a doctor about that? Can I help? You know, if you're the person offering that assistance, that might be all that particular woman or child needs to take that step forward to create a safe place for themselves.
Yeah, and I guess that's where the problems with service delivery and the criminal justice come in after that happens, which is a whole other problem, I guess.
Yeah, and, you know, Australia is a society when people don't want to get involved in other people's business.
Mm.
You know, we might see in a park someone fighting and people just turn the other way and keep walking.
Yeah.
And I think as bystanders to this, we actually have a responsibility. If we want to create a safe world for our families and for our children, we actually have to stand up against violence. We have to, when we see it, we actually, you know, have to do something about it. We should feel morally obligated to do something about it and not ignore it. And, you know, it doesn't take much to say to someone, you know, are you okay? You know, that's not a hard ask to ask someone, are you okay?
Yeah.
Can I do anything to help? Yeah, you know, I'm worried about you.
Yeah, definitely. And just ending, because I know you have to go soon, but from the going back to the Royal Commission, what do you, I mean, you said before you don't, I mean, it's really easy to be cynical about this given that we've had so many reports, but I guess, do you think enough of an Aboriginal voice came out of that Royal Commission and do you think anything may change?
I think in terms of what I was reading in the report, I think a number of people testified to the Royal Commission. They were people that had vested interests in the community in terms of being service providers. I think it would be nice to actually create an opportunity to hear the voices of victims.
Yeah.
So it's not the service providers reporting the victims' experiences all the time, but it's actually the victims telling their stories about accessing services, accessing police. You know, let's try and create opportunities to hear them so that we can get a more nuanced understanding of how the service sector is responding to Indigenous issues. And I think that's the important part. I think there is what we saw in the Commission's report is what I'd expect to see.
Yeah.
Services demonstrating and reporting that that there is a huge problem of family violence in our community and that the community control sector is the best sector to deal with that.
Right.
I'd expect to hear that. I think we need to hear more about the nuances of what actually happens in the context of that violence. And a Royal Commission isn't necessarily, you know, that can be a foreboding experience in and of itself for anybody testifying to a Royal Commission and, you know, trying to facilitate that for victims to be a part of that process would be difficult. So I measure my criticism there. I think but I would like to see more of the nuance.
Yeah,
Go.
Oh, no, I was saying it directly informs your criticism about a victim and might not be able to go to those services as well. So I think it's a really important point to make.
Violence is so nuanced in so many respects. And I think as much as the Commission were able to demonstrate some of those nuances, I think to through the voices of victims and of offenders, we can actually start, you know, we'll be able to start to look at this problem in a more holistic way.
That was Dr. Kylie Cripps from the University of New South Wales, and hopefully we'll get her on the program again to go into these issues in more detail. We'll go to a song now, a bit of Thelma Plum, who's also a strong Aboriginal woman, strong young Aboriginal woman. I don't know if you've seen her advocating all across the country when she sees racism online, completely calling it out. I think she's absolutely brilliant. So we'll hear from her next, one of her songs. And after that, after the break, we'll come back with Jackie Huggins, who's the co-chair of the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples. And she joined me a couple of weeks ago as she was driving down to Canberra to mark the anniversary of another Royal Commission, the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. But today we're talking about the Royal Commission into Family Violence and how Aboriginal women could be affected particularly. So we'll go to Thelma Plum and after the break, Jackie Huggins.
Sailing past the wind, past the wind. My father said, now son, don't help me out. You're sailing past the wind, past the wind. My father said, now son, don't help me out. And now he's crying, crying out for love. And now he's working up from above. He's sailing past the wind, past the wind. My father said, now son, don't help me out. He's sailing past the wind, past the wind. My father said, now son, don't help me out. And now he's crying, crying out for love. And now he's working, working up from above. Bum, 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 bum. Dum, 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 dum. Dum, 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 dum. Dum, dum.
You've had a long history in actually looking at family violence from an Aboriginal perspective. When you consider the Royal Commission into Family Violence in Victoria, what are your sort of thoughts initially when you hear about that, given that there's been so many reports in the past and very few evaluation?
Yes, well, Amy, I think that this has been one of the sleeper issues in our communities for a long, long time. When I say sleeper, it's not that it hasn't been around, but the attention that has escalated over the past, I would say, maybe 5 years to family and domestic violence is really important, and I'm glad, you know, there's been spotlights on it. You know, way back in the 80s, the Aboriginal Women Task Force in Queensland, in fact, did a report. I have to say that unfortunately that wasn't taken up as it might have been by the state government. And, you know, a lot of that stuff still hasn't changed, you know, very much. It's still saying we need more women's refuges, culturally appropriate places where women and children can go to, a whole range of things, which we're still saying today. So unfortunately, you know, all the reports, all the goodwill, you know, we really do need to now translate to something that's tangible and something that has better outcomes, especially for Aboriginal women and children.
I think it's great. The Victorian government actually announced, I think, $500 million today to be sort of funneled into the recommendations in the report. Do you have hope? I know a couple of, I think 23 million of that is going to be specifically dedicated to the Aboriginal recommendations. When you consider sort of that funding commitment, does that give you a bit more optimism about the future down in Victoria at least?
Yes, look, I read that this morning in terms of the 23 million, and I think that is absolutely fantastic because I know, having worked with some wonderful women like Antoinette Braybrook and Muriel Cadd, Muriel Bamblett actually now, that, you know, they have been working tirelessly to bring about some change, but also to be adequately resourced and funded by governments and others. So, you know, I take that up as a real testimony to their very hard work and the work that they've been doing behind the scenes and right up front, and very, you know, very vocal in terms of wanting to get additional funding and be properly resourced. I mean, it's all right, you know, for everyone to say, you know, we need these things, but unless you're really resourced around that, you can't do it on the smell of an oily rag. And it's really good that the Victorian government now sees the value in terms of their consultation with Aboriginal community controlled organisations and the way that's led to this very fine report, but this great outcome for women in the state of Victoria, at least.
You mentioned before that family violence has largely been a sleeper issue. I mean, I guess there's very specific reasons why family violence is in existence in Aboriginal communities today. Do you see that recognised enough, the very different experience a lot of Aboriginal women have in relation to family violence?
Yes, look, I think there are a number of factors why, you know, there's a lot of underreporting that that goes on in our communities. And, you know, one of them is, of course, the issue around, you know, our kinship and how that's tied up with each other, and, you know, being not wanting our mainly men, it is, of course, who are the major perpetrators of family violence. You know, there are some cases where women are violent as well, but I think it's about, I think the figure is about 98% is perpetrated by men in our communities. And of course, you know, we're all connected in some way. And just, you know, this Friday, actually, tomorrow, we are commemorating the 25th anniversary of Aboriginal deaths in custody. So I know way back in my time, you know, 30 years when we started talking about family and domestic violence, you know, it was very much a taboo subject, you know. Everyone said, oh, no, hush, hush, you shouldn't be talking about this. Now it's really out there and in the open, and, you know, I think things have changed for the better for our community.
It is very complex because obviously it is such a gendered problem, isn't it? And yet at the same time, I feel people want it, a lot of communities do fear coming out because of what the, you know, the repercussions that can often have on whole communities, not just, I guess, the perpetrators. Do you think we're changing, or do you think the debate is changing, that I guess Aboriginal women will feel a lot more safe to come out without having these really hard-handed repercussions that ultimately hurt them more?
Yes, Amy, look, I really do think, and I would hope that women will come out a lot more. I'm not quite sure what the statistics say about that, but if they're feeling safe to, you know, expose family violence within their own families and in their own communities, then that's a really good thing. But, you know, I think the more spotlight that's put on it, the better, because then they're able to, you know, start reporting what's actually happened to them. And it is such an epidemic, family violence in our communities. You know, rates like incarceration rates are getting worse rather than, you know, getting better. So I really welcome this, you know, the opportunity from Victoria in terms of, you know, even the Koori courts, you know, being able to being equipped to deal with family violence matters as well. And look, I understand, I've just read this morning too, that the Murray courts in Queensland are being getting back into running, which is great because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but under the previous government they were dismantled, and now I think 13 have been set up again, which is really good. And why I talk about, you know, criminal justice is that family violence, most of the women who are in our prisons are usually victims of family violence, or they have, you know, been perpetrators themselves. So this is, you know, this interconnection, I think, is really important to note.
I think there's also criticism I was reading around the Crown Court recommendation, just largely about the fact that it might seem to be more lenient on offenders rather than provide sort of an avenue for the victims. Is that a concern? I think that's a really hard balance because I think we're all victims in a sense, really, even the perpetrators of family violence.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, there's been some work done on the perpetrators of family violence too. It's been a study, mostly, you know, there's a lot that comes out of Victoria, and there's been some work around the perpetrators and, you know, hopefully, you know, what can be done to also assist in their kind of, what shall I say, you know, in their kind of the angst, I guess, and the anger and anger management and all that stuff, you know, that they feel, rather than diversionary programs, I hope, that would stop them, you know, acting out or creating violence or even, you know, going to jail sometimes. So, yeah, there's been a lot of work done in that area which we haven't seen in previous times as well, because you're right, domestic family violence is a no-win situation for anybody. You know, all of our families have suffered greatly from it, and you know, no one's immune from it. So you know, it's about how we're able to you know, come together and really work through these issues. But it's also a legislative process as well. So there's been you know, a lot of spotlight on it, and I would hope that, you know, that filters down to really good healing programs for our mob as well, because that's where it's got to start and finish, of course.
I think it's very interesting. Yeah, I think it's really great that we've got the spotlight on it as well. I was just wondering your thoughts, just, I guess, because Aboriginal women have felt silenced for so long, I guess, you know. You yourself and so many other women have been talking about this issue for so long and have just been being ignored. I mean, how, being heard, do you think that's going to have an impact at a more grassroots level? More Aboriginal women might feel equipped to even talk about the language of family violence? Because I know that's been a problem as well, whereas you might not even acknowledge it as a family violence because you're so used to not being heard. Like, having this spotlight in an Aboriginal context, would that help women on the ground, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. Giving them a voice and letting them, you know, voice and have a narrative around their story as well, and you know, what's happened to them and their families, I think is really important. You know, I have been 14 years now. I've been on the Queensland Centre for Domestic and Family Violence Research in Mackay, and every year we have a forum by which, you know, we bring together a lot of the family violence service providers and the people who work at the coalface, who are doing, you know, terrific programs. You know, we don't often hear about those people or their programs, but within their communities they do fantastic work, and it's kind of like, it's almost like a best practice kind of forum, you know, where people talk about what's happening in their communities and how they've, you know, how they've put together these programs, a lot at, you know, very little cost, and a lot that run, and you know, men's groups as well. You know, they're very important in terms of eradicating the violence, because the solution lies with our men and our women. And you know, I think the whole gender debate now has been one in which that in the past, Aboriginal women weren't very much listened to in terms of saying, if we're to do anything about family violence, we've got to heal our men as well. And there's an absolute imperative now, I think, right across the board of family violence and the language that's used, is that, you know, we have to look at men as well in terms of being, you know, part of that that solution of what lies at the heart of family violence. Because without their assistance and without their coming to join us, you know, we're not going to get anywhere fast. So that's been, I think, a bit of a change that I've seen, you know, over 30 years in terms of talking about this stuff. You know, once upon a time, you were absolutely you were absolutely held down at feminist conferences and so forth because you happened to mention, you know, we've got to do something about the brothers. And and now they say it. They're saying it now too. So they say the same thing. So that's been a bit of a shift, which I think is good for all our communities, you know, where we have our men and our women playing huge roles in terms of eradicating violence.
It's interesting you say that, because I often feel really frustrated still, because I've read the work you've done and people like mm-hmm. Pat O'Shane really criticising, you know, that white feminist movement. And I still feel that's similarly the case now, in a way that just because there's so much focus on mainstream feminism and misogyny as the root cause of family violence, and I guess I see it as completely different in Aboriginal communities. This idea that, I guess, too much focus on misogyny, but I don't know if that's right. You know, I see it more as the trauma in our communities. Do you still see it that way? That's the main problem?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think you're dead right in terms of it is, you know, it's a generational post-traumatic stress and trauma that that happens, you know. And I think at any level you can break that cycle that you've actually become involved with. And then that can happen in a whole myriad of ways, you know, if you move or if you get a good job or you get education, you know, one of those cycles that can be broken that will, you know, help women get out of very violent relationships is a good thing. And, you know, of course, the children that are absolutely, sometimes they're relegated to the periphery of all this stuff, you know. But what I understand about the Victorian business is that, you know, that report had heard that children's voices were being recognised and that they were being responded to, which is good because, you know, quite often we don't hear them. Look, I think I'm feeling pretty happy at this report, and the fact that it was really consulted very well, from what I believe, from you know, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Family Violence Network in children's groups in Victoria. So I think it was pretty sound from the outset. And as you know, Amy, you know, you start with something that's from the ground up, and you know, you actually get the results now that they're reaping in Victoria. So I think it's you know, a very good thing, and it should be followed in each state. I know in Queensland we had the Not Now, Not Ever report by Dame Quinton Bryce. Look, I'm not quite sure, but I'd like to find out, you know, where that is at the moment. But, you know, I think we can follow suit from, you know, what's happened to our people in Victoria. I think good things are happening down there, and we need to, you know, keep that focus up.
So another Royal Commission maybe in Queensland, would you say, or even?
Yes, yeah. yes, you never know. And I think the Premier of Victoria has called on other states to follow suit, so that would be really good.
That was Jackie Huggins from the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples, and also earlier in the program, Kylie Cripps from the University of New South Wales, a Palawan woman from Tasmania. That's all we have time for today on Let's Talk. Join us tomorrow, 98.9.